This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll listen to a mother share her story about life as the parent of a young transgender child. But first, bassist and composer Mario Pavone is one of the first jazz musicians I sought out when I came to Connecticut. I knew the jagged, freewheeling music he was playing at the time with the late saxophonist Tom Chapin, but only from his records. He was the first Connecticut artist I profiled when I came here in 1994. Years later, he joined us on Where We Live to talk about the art of improvisation at Firehouse 12 in New Haven. Here he is playing with trumpeter Taylor Hobina. Now today, Where We Live, Mario Pavone joins us once again, this time in our Studio 3, along with one of his longtime musical collaborators, saxophonist Jimmy Green. Green is one of the most in-demand jazz players in the world, and like Pavone, he grew up in Connecticut, and he still lives right here. Today, we'll hear them playing together, as they often have, improvising for us. But they'll also be previewing their performances next weekend at the Litchfield Jazz Festival in Goshen. The festival goes all weekend long, and we'll have more information on our website, WNPR.org. Before we talk to Jimmy Green and Mario Pavone, let's listen as they play for us live, Where We Live. That's Mario Pavone and Jimmy Green performing live in our Studio 3 here on Where We Live. Mario Pavone, the great bassist and composer. Jimmy Green, a saxophonist and composer, and also an assistant professor of music and assistant coordinator of jazz studies at Western Connecticut State University. They both play key roles in this year's upcoming Litchfield Jazz Festival. On Sunday, August 10th, they'll be performing back-to-back with their ensembles. We'll be telling you more about that throughout the course of our program. But I'm thrilled to have Mario Pavone back on our program and Jimmy Green here in studio. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having us, John.
I have to say it's a great pleasure for me to have not only two of the best voices in contemporary jazz in our studio, but also that you're here in our state. That you make Connecticut home, and I know that both of you are very passionate about the fact that Connecticut is your home. I'm wondering if you can just tell me quickly, Mario, you've been playing with this guy for a while. How long you know Jimmy Green?
I think in 1999 or 2000 we recorded. Actually, we recorded in Vermont, I think, an album called Totem Blues on a Knitting Factory label. And we've recorded, I guess, three or four albums, double tenor albums and stuff, and it's just a measure of how the music is. And you can talk about Connecticut, but we can talk about there's so many styles today in the music, and Jimmy's and I's, but all within the same language of improvised music and the emotion and the love, and musicians meet on so many different planes, it seems to me, today, that it's just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting, this idea of musicians meeting on different planes. So you've played with Mario a number of times. What we just heard is essentially an improvisation off the top of your heads, the both of you. How much does it matter, Jimmy, that you know a guy, like you know where Mario is going to go, versus sharing a similar language but being paired up with someone who you've never played music with before?
Well, that's a good observation. There is something to be said for familiarity. You know, I have played with Mario a lot and have enjoyed every single time. But the thing is, I really don't know where he's going to go. Mm-hmm. So I have to listen, keep my ears wide open, and we have to listen out for each other and try to make the best musical decisions we can in the moment. So that's always a lot of fun. We didn't discuss anything about what we're going to play just then. We just tried to listen and express collectively, you know, whatever was going on in the room just now.
I'm so interested in this idea, and Mario was good enough some years ago to do a performance like this with us down at Firehouse 12, where we talked about improvisation, and I'd like to hear you both talk a bit more about that. What is it you listen for the layperson who wonders, how can these guys just off the top of their heads make music in that way together? What are some things that you're listening for? What are some things that you're keying off of, Mario, in order to be able to just spontaneously improvise?
Well, many things. Much of the technical things, harmonic and rhythmical things, you're listening for where he might be hovering for a moment harmonically, and how you want to relate to it. You're listening to ranges, high, low, so many, you know, musical considerations. And mostly, I think the generosity of spirit is helpful in this thing. You're just kind of giving, and it's part of the music. It is a built-in thing of the music. But certainly there are so many musical things you're thinking. This is a moment-to-moment music.
Jimmy, pick up on that a little bit more. What are some things you're listening for? How do you think about that in your head? And maybe how do you translate that to young musicians who you work with who maybe are just trying to grasp the idea of improvisation?
Well, the idea of improvisation is there's a lot going on. Right. And for a young student, I know when I was young, I can only say from my experience, sometimes there's too much going on for me to grasp all of it. So you have to go through stages of what you can grasp. Right. For instance, a young student would maybe grasp something like rhythm first, which I think is the most important thing to grasp in the first place. And then they can grasp some aspect of harmony and then melody. And texture, and then, you know, then you get into the art areas where you're dealing with people, right? So you're, like Mario said, you're giving and you're taking and you're being democratic about who has a chance to speak and who, you know, and taking turns having a conversation. And once you do those things, everything's kind of mixed and jumbled up. So depending on the moment is depending on what you're thinking of. So at some moments I was listening to Mario for to see if he was in a harmonic area. And I'm sure he was listening to me to see if I was in one. and then we were having conversation, and then we were expressing some aspects of rhythm, and then I was trying to express some aspects of melody, which, you know, and then it kind of fed the conversation. So it's a conversation, I guess.
But playing music like this is it is sort of this high wire act, and there's all these things going on. But I think people who listen to jazz can also hear some very important threads in the music. There are some threads that take you down a path where the music sounds more freely improvised. It sounds more spontaneous. And you're both, of course, composers, and you both work within that idiom too. Talk a bit, Jimmy, about how that works, translating the composed environment that you both live in to the freely improvised, the spontaneous music that you're playing for us today.
Well, in my opinion, composition and improvisation are kind of two branches off the same tree. Improvisation is just a more immediate and less permanently fixed version of composition, right? When you're playing a single note instrument like the saxophone, you're composing melodies as you improvise. And some of those melodies, you know, will really be meaningful. And some not so much, you know. But the challenge is to take the ones that aren't so meaningful and spin them to something that is meaningful, you know, in real time, which is it's a supreme challenge. It's something you never, ever quite master. But if you're really improvising, it's something that's always just the most fun challenge ever.
And this is interesting, too. From your role as a bassist, Mario, you are spontaneously creating some of these melodies. And as a composer, you want to create memorable melodies. But you're also trying to provide a different structure for the music, perhaps, than Jimmy is, as he's melodically gliding over things. Explain your role as a bassist here.
Well, that might be certain harmonic aspects that I might be taking care of, or even form. The listener might relate to the fact that, like, as a composer, which is kind of where my engine is as a player and band leader, and it does keep me going. The discovery of 30 years ago of writing from the bass, I'm trying to blur in some ways that line that we're talking about between composition and improvisation. And, you know, in some ways, you write a great written, let's call it a tune or a written part, and if it sounds has an improvisational aspect to it. In some ways, you feel that's one aspect where I was successful. And when we're improvising, the more it has this feeling of unity, which maybe the written material might lend itself to. That, to me, that's a success. That's what successful is.
We're talking today with Mario Pavone. He's a bassist and composer. Jimmy Green is a saxophonist and composer, and they're both performing as part of the Litchfield Jazz Festival coming up this Sunday, August 10th. Of course, the festival is a weekend-long event, and there's more information about it on our website, WNPR.org. Back-to-back, Mario Pavone will be playing with his newest project, Mario Pavone Street Songs, the Accordion Project. That's at 1:45 on Sunday. Jimmy Green with his quartet at 3:45 later on that afternoon. We're going to be hearing more music from them in our Studio 3 in just a little bit. Mario, of all the many projects you've worked on, tell us about this Accordion Project. What are people going to hear on Sunday?
Well, I've always wanted to do something with an accordion, first of all, And I often enjoyed having two basses. And I asked Carl, a wonderful bass player, graduated from Wesleyan, to recommend an accordion player. And Adam turns out to be a wonderful story to Adam Matlock, a storyteller and a very lovely player. The idea for this music, when I wrote it a year ago and then recorded it about 6 months ago, it was released in May, was reflections on my growing up in Waterbury in the post-World War II era, say from 1945 to 50 primarily, where I can remember hearing the accordion involved with front stoop music, I called it, both Italian, Portuguese, and Polish families throughout my neighborhood. It was Lower Ballin Street in Waterbury. 84 sits right over it now, the juncture. But I can remember it, and I can remember the feeling and stuff. And as a corollary to that, I also became aware of the idea of memory and listening, memory and music being united in some way. And the idea especially emerges when you talk about, let's say, the listener being still and the music moving, or the opposite, the music being stationary and the listener moving. We could talk about parades as one example.
Yeah.
Or in the 50s, it was the doo-wop tunes going by in the car, and then boomboxes later, and then hip-hop going by and the cars bouncing. And yet, you know, you might be walking, they might be moving. I had this experience in Tanglewood in 1968. I was up there teaching at Chuck Israeli's camp, and I heard a rehearsal with Leonard Bernstein conducting of Alban Berg's Wacek, the opera. And I was a half a mile away, and, you know, that beautiful green up there at Tanglewood, and I could hear everything perfectly clear. And we walked, a bunch of musicians that were doing the workshop, we walked into the music all the way up. It's just the whole idea of this movement. It actually occurred to me at the school last year, the last couple of years, at jazz camp, the Litchfield Jazz Camp, when I'd walk down the hall, and the rooms were not completely soundproof, of course, so I'd hear the students playing, say, a Frank Foster Simone, and then the next piece I would hear Wayne Shorter's Footprints, and go down, and one would fade as the other would emerge, and they would mash up a little bit and stuff. And just the idea of it seemed, you know, tied in with memory and music.
But I love this idea, too, of it being central around the movement from one place to another, because there's a lot of ways in which we do mash up music every day now in a way that we weren't able to many generations ago. But that idea of wandering through a neighborhood and hearing music calling out of one storefront in one way and then another storefront another way, this is a huge part of human experience that I think you're picking up on that, you know, I guess in the moment I don't think of so much, but I love the idea that you're picking up on this musically.
Yeah, I think it really is prevalent now in this complicated world, in the sound world, where sound can be disturbing, intrusive, but also beautiful. I mean, I guess if you go way back, Carnival in Brazil and the Black Orpheus thing and that kind of feeling of the parades coming on, very evocative.
Yeah. I'm wondering, do you have some of the same experiences, Jimmy, as you think about growing up or think about your neighborhoods, this idea that Mario's talking about music sort of shifting as you go from place to place?
Yeah, I can totally resonate with that. When you're driving down the street or walking down the street, you hear music coming from different houses, you know. And when I grew up, the place I grew up, unfortunately, people weren't making their own music, you know, coming out of the house. It was usually what was playing on the radio, you know. I would have liked to experience that, you know, hearing people making their own music coming out of houses but yeah, that's an experience that I'm sure we've all had, hearing blend one to the next.
It's such an interesting point, though, you make, is that there are some cultures, and I've certainly talked with a number of musicians who grew up with the playing front porch stoop music in Appalachia or someplace, you know, where it was just natural that everyone picked up a guitar and you played music. And certainly there are places in our urban areas all across New England where that happens, but you're picking up on something different, which is, you don't hear as many people playing saxophone out the window. You hear a lot more people playing the radio. I don't know if that's a good thing, a bad thing. I don't know what it says about us culturally, but it does seem to be something that's real.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, part of my passion to teach about music and it comes from that. It's just when I was a little kid, my dad wasn't a professional musician, but he loved music. And he taught himself songwriting, and he actually produced some actual records back in the early 70s. And for me, the act of music making wasn't a mystery. It wasn't something that was beyond my grasp. It was something that I saw. You know, I saw him do it. So it was always something that I felt like I can do this too. And that's a thing, you know, we deal today with access to instruments, access to instruction. A lot of our urban school systems don't have instruments or instruction for young kids. And I feel very strongly that is something we really need to bring back in our culture. One thing that I'm very excited about, a couple things I'm very excited about. Number one, the Artist Collective. They've always been kind of a beacon for here in Hartford and around the country of arts education in the inner city and how to model that and how to do it at the highest level. And I'm also very encouraged by the Capital Region Education Council here in Hartford, who they have magnet schools. Now, when I was a high school student, I went to the high school, Greater Hartford Academy of the Arts. Now there's a middle school and there's an elementary school, which I'm very proud to still be in touch with. So those things are really, really key in increasing access. I'd like to see not just the magnet schools, but all the public schools really increase access to the arts, because it's so important for our society.
And, of course, one of the things that you've both been involved with, because you've been involved with the Litchfield Jazz Festival for so long, is Mario mentioned this jazz camp. You taught at the jazz camp when you were 22 years old, and years and years ago, Jimmy. Talk about how important the Litchfield Jazz Festival and the Associated Jazz Camp has been toward getting some opportunities for kids who maybe didn't think they were going to be jazz musicians, and actually now many of them, and I know many of them, become professional musicians out of this.
I think it's an amazing opportunity to not only get instruction and coaching and mentoring by some of the world's great jazz musicians, but also to be around one another, other kids that have similar interests and similar passion. I found that when I was a youngster coming up, that was almost as important as the instruction, was just being around your peers, because those are the people you spend the most time with, your peers. And if you're all kind of heading toward the same direction, you're going to push each other and you're going to inspire one another.
Yeah. Mario, talk about that a little bit, too, because I think getting young people together who are interested in this music, because it is not the music that most kids that age are listening to, it seems as though that's got to be a very fertile environment. It has to be something that has to be maintained if the music, frankly, is going to survive, you know, all the other options that people have.
Absolutely. You can observe it literally over the course of a week. And we talked about it yesterday, actually, as a new class, a partly new class came in. It's a five-week program. And about you're with your peers, you're meeting for 3 hours a day in an ensemble, and you're hanging out with them, and you're talking, and you're watching the model, really, of the instructor education. Educators and can learn a lot from that. I think something happened when first it was a lot of great transposition of stuff in Charlie Parker and the education thing is small, but the YouTube or the visual idea of seeing the players, I think this really caused this fabulous quantum leap in kids that are interested in this music, in the learning rate and cycle, because seeing a player, seeing John Coltrane or Stan Getz or all of the great players, seeing them play is speaks to the kids, I think, better. And it's empowering. I think it's empowering. These kids have taken an instrument. Maybe some will not be still playing years from now. They'll be lawyers or doctors. Some will. I always encourage them, whether music is your path, that it can still be a source of great pleasure and mixed in with your life if you have another life, let's say, as a career.
The idea of YouTube enabling us to see the great performers throughout the years, and I'll do the same thing. I'll fall down these YouTube holes where all of a sudden I'll be watching, you know, Miles Davis concerts from the late 1960s and thinking, I didn't even know this was on video. And there's something to be said for this. I mean, you know, we couldn't capture Mozart on video, Jimmy Green. And you know, we can talk about classical music all we want, but we never got to see his virtuosity. But you can literally, as Mario said, you can see some of these amazing recordings of John Coltrane playing your instrument the way only he could. And that's got to be inspirational to you and to a 14-year-old, too.
Oh, absolutely it is. It's an amazing it's an amazing thing that we have, the technology we have today. And kids today have more access to more music than ever before. When I was their age, I would have loved to be able to check out all the things they can check out at a couple of mouse clicks. There are some things I wish I could see. I wish I could see some videos of Jelly Roll Morton playing, you know, and things like that. But Buddy Bolden. But you know, we have a wealth of stuff that we can access, and that's a really good thing.
We're talking with Jimmy Green and Mario Pavone. They're both playing integral parts at the Litchfield Jazz Festival, which is happening next weekend, August 8th, 9th, and 10th. On Sunday, August 10th, Mario Pavone's newest project, Mario Pavone's Street Songs, the Accordion Project, is happening at 1:45 p.m. Jimmy Green with his quartet happening at 3:45. When we come back from our break, we'll be talking more with Jimmy Green about the music that we'll be hearing at the Litchfield Jazz Fest. And we'll also be hearing some more music from them in our Studio 3 here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're previewing the Litchfield Jazz Festival, which happens on August 8th, 9th, and 10th. And we have in studio with us two of my favorite musicians, and they're two major voices in jazz. They both happen to make Connecticut their home, not just because they ended up here, but because they have deep, deep ties to this state. Jimmy Green is a saxophonist and composer. He's also professor of music at Western Connecticut State University. Mario Pavone is the great bassist and composer who has been in our program a number of times teaching us about improvisation and about jazz. We heard a bit about Mario's new program, which is coming up. It's his Street Songs project, which is happening on the 10th at Litchfield Jazz Festival. Jimmy Green is playing with his quartet just after that. So there's an awful lot of music in just a compressed period of time on Sunday afternoon. More information about the Jazz Festival at WNPR.org. Jimmy, tell us about your quartet. Who's in your quartet now and what are you playing?
Well, it's kind of, I have to pinch myself to say this is my quartet. But they're actually playing and it's going to be my music and I'll be talking on the mic, so I guess it'll be my quartet. For this concert, I wanted to have the musicians that participate on my last recording, which will be released probably in the later part of this year. And the recording is a tribute to the beautiful life of my daughter, Anna, who was one of the Sandy Hook School victims. And the musicians on the recording, generally in the last 10, 12 years, I've been playing with my quartet with some amazing musicians who have generally been my peers, people who, you know, we've kind of share a common, we've come up at the same time. We kind of entered the scene around the same time. And, you know, but for this recording and also for this performance at Litchfield, I wanted to have some of my good friends that I looked up to when I was first coming up, musicians that predated me on the scene and who have made big marks in the jazz world. So, and I've played with them many, many times. And I was commenting to someone yesterday, one day it's my quartet, Litchfield will be my quartet. Yesterday we played at the Caramore Jazz Festival, and it was Rini Rosin's quartet.
Ah, okay.
And a lot of times we played different places, and it's been Louis Nash's quartet. So we just enjoy playing together quite a bit, and I've gotten the chance to play with them quite often since I joined Louis Nash's band in 1997. So the rhythm section is Rini Rosin's on piano, Peter Washington on bass, and Louis Nash on drums.
It's going to be fantastic. You mentioned, of course, the life of your daughter, Anna Grace. Obviously, I can't imagine how the tragedy has changed you personally. How do you think that going through what you've gone through has changed the way you express yourself musically?
Well, I can tell you about this recording. A lot of the writing and a lot of the songs have lyrics and have singers on them too. A lot of the writing comes from the deep sense of pain and loss, but also from the great joy and hope that I have. In our future, in where Anna resides now, my faith, and I can't really put words to how it's changed me. I just know that, you know, there will never be something as normal again. Life won't ever be the same as it was before this horrible tragedy happened to my family. But I feel it's my job, and my wife feels the same, that we have to do our best every day to just keep moving and to somehow do all we can so that this world is a little bit better.
Hmm. If we could, let's hear a little bit more music. And we've been very lucky. We asked Jimmy Green and Mario Pavone to come with their instruments, a tenor saxophone and a bass, and play some duets for us with no preparation in advance. And so we're looking forward to hearing a little bit more music from Jimmy Green and Mario Pavone in advance of the Litchfield Jazz Festival, which they're both such a big part of. We'll give you more information about that coming up. But now, let's hear some music in our studio, Three on Where We Live. Thank you. That's Jimmy Green and Mario Pavone playing live in our Studio 3 for us here. Jimmy Green, of course, the great saxophonist. Mario Pavone, the bassist. They're joining us to preview the Litchfield Jazz Festival, which they'll both be performing at on Sunday, the 10th. Of course, it is a weekend-long event, and it's so great to hear you playing these improvisational duets for us. One of the reasons I was really looking forward to this, Mario, is not just because I love you both as musicians and wanted to hear you play together. It's because I've been thinking a lot about this format, as I'm sure you have. Charlie Hayden died not so long ago, and I've spent an awful lot of time listening back to some of the amazing duet recordings he's made with pianists and saxophonists and guitarists over the years. Could you talk a bit about, as a bassist, his influence on your playing, but also just on the music that you play?
Yeah, he's had a huge influence on me and just about every... I mean, he's one of the... major sounds in the music, not just bass sounds. Charlie established something in there based from his sound that started a great thing, and duos is something he always liked to play. And he also, of course, really was an entry in discovering how to play with, say, the great Ornette Coleman and switching range, and it became this natural counterpoint to Ornette. And then from this incredible freedom and his just taking it in hand and using it with Ornette and going with it into this great lyricism, also his Quartet West records and stuff. He just, as a player and as a sound, I can't overstate his influence on me.
And that's the thing. You mentioned sound, and it's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. I think that for both of you, the sound is so key. And there's so much to jazz technique, but really it's about establishing a personal sound. You both have that. Maybe I'll ask you first to talk about that, Mario, but how do you develop that? I mean, on an instrument like a bass, people might think, well, Charlie Hayden played the bass like a lot of other people. How could he have a specific sound? You listen to the record and you know a few notes in that this is this man playing.
Exactly.
How do you establish that?
Gee, you go down deep in your music and why you play music. For me, I have to say I had so many challenges. I started late at 24 years old and still really had a limited amount of school knowledge. I've learned a lot from mentors that I played with. I learned every minute from when I played with Jimmy and all of the vast amount of players. But for me, it was actually something that came pretty early. I used to record myself all the time, and it was cassettes back then, and they were a terrible medium. I used to sound terrible. God, I sounded terrible. And I'd record every day. And after a while, I sounded better. And after a while, I started to discern in there what my sound was, what my music was. Turned out some things about tritone and whole tone music rather than, say, a 5-1 resolution. My ear started wanting to go against that and do some other things, as I say, in the whole tone area. But I started before pickups were really around. There was no pickups and amplifiers. I would play all night long in New York with and people like Archie Shepp and Albert Eiler. I played sessions with these guys.
These are not guys who were playing soft.
We were playing loud. It would go loud for 8 or 9 hours. And, you know, we were just, you know. So it still lingers as I play too hard in some ways. But so sound became very integral and very paramount for me.
Jimmy, how do you think about that idea of sound? Because for a young saxophonist specifically, I mean, you're making this music with your breath and you are establishing something that sounds kind of like a vocal creation, but it's coming through your instrument. Talk about creating a sound for yourself.
Yeah, that's a very good observation, John. You're really trying to sing through the instrument. There's a lot of technical things that go into making a sound. Now, every human being is different, so the application of those technical things can look very different between different players. But at the essence, you know, the favorite people we listen to, like you mentioned with Charlie Hayden's sound, you know, if I listen to my favorite saxophonists, you know, within two, three notes, you know who it is. You know if it's Wayne Shorter or if it's Dexter Gordon or if it's Lester Young or if it's Sonny Stitt or Charlie Parker, you know. So I think developing a sound, there's a lot to it. I was really blessed to study for many years with one of the great sounds ever on the saxophone, Jackie McLean. And he had a very meticulous long tone routine that he had all of his students do. And I listened to a lot of my peers, the guys I went to school with and other guys I studied with Jackie, and none of us sound like each other, you know. There's a couple examples of maybe people that sound a little bit, you can hear a little of his sound in it, right? But by and large, we all sound different. And that's because we're all built differently. I can't, as much as I loved Sonny Rollins' sound and still do, and when I was coming up, I tried to sound just like him, I never will. I never could. Same with Dexter Gordon. Same with John Coltrane. You have my body is different than theirs. My requirements as far as equipment are going to be slightly different based on, you know, the way my body works, the way I blow, the way my oral cavity is shaped and all that sort of stuff. So you kind of, after a while of the period when you're really trying your best to emulate your heroes, you kind of live with, and it comes from listening to yourself back on recordings and liking what you hear and wanting some things to be slightly different and making certain adjustments. You kind of live with who you are. And becoming an adult and growing older, you kind of accept who you are, and then hopefully you like who you are. So it's a, you know, parallel to life, I guess.
But I love this idea of talking about the physicality of making the music, because I think people don't give it enough credit. So much music can be made today, and very good music, with computers. I mean, sitting in front of a Macintosh computer, you can make a lot of great music without ever getting your body involved. But the music that you make, the music that Mario makes, I mean, you're literally wrestling with these instruments, and you're trying to figure out a way to through the body you've been given, make something come out. That's a really specific thing, and it must be something that young musicians maybe have a harder time understanding, but then as they get older, they finally get.
Yeah. For me, there's nothing that beats the sound of if you hit a drum with a drumstick, you know,
or
if you play a chord on an acoustic piano, a really nice piano, or Mario plays a bass note on a double bass like that. You feel the vibration in your body in a way that a computer can't do, at least for me. I hope a lot of people feel the same. The computers, I use my computer every single day to compose music. It's a great tool to have, but it will never replace the sound and the feeling of live musicians.
Yeah. And to that end, as I let you guys go after a wonderful conversation, I really appreciate you both joining us. Talk a bit about the festival that you're both playing at together, Mario. The Litchfield Jazz Festival is an opportunity for people to come together, hear live music in an open space, and hear a lot of different types of music. You know, jazz sometimes has a hard time making its voice heard amongst all the other things that are out there. It would seem as though an opportunity like this once a year in Connecticut to come together and have a festival like this is probably a pretty important thing to keep going.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really a major event, and it's also a tremendous bargain. You're hearing five or six groups each day for a ticket that you would pay to hear any one of us in New York, frankly. Yeah. So you're getting six wonderful variety of groups, and it's just important. It's a lovely setting up there in Goshen. The Litchfield Jazz Festival has gone through various stages and moved its location at times, but we're back in one of the original spots, and it's a beautiful view, great acoustical tent. There's a NASA-type tent, which is – the acoustics in there are just wonderful and great sound people. So it's top of the line that way, and it's a great way to enjoy the music. And I just encourage everyone to think about coming up and supporting it. And by supporting it, you're supporting the music, expanding yourself, supporting the kids that go to the camp and the scholarships that we give out. And it's our 19th annual, and it's one of the major cultural events. And in Connecticut.
It really is a major event and a different way to hear music, because I mean, both of you guys have spent so many years playing at festivals like this, but also playing in tiny clubs. This is a different way to hear music, and I think, Jimmy, an important way periodically, even if you like going to clubs, to hear music in a very, very different space.
I think it's important, like Mario said, you get, you know, so many bands and so many different sounds for one low price. I mean, you can't beat that. And, you know, I think it's very important for us here in Connecticut. You know, Newport Jazz Festival is close by, so is Montreal, is not that far. But this is our, you know, this is our big festival here in Connecticut, and I think it's important, you know, for music lovers to support live music. Art Blakey used to say, and I got this from Ralph Peterson, who was around art quite a bit and a great drummer in his own right. He would say, please support live music so we, the musicians, can keep appearing instead of disappearing.
Mm.
So I think it's pretty important.
That's a very important thing. And these two will appear at the Litchfield Jazz Festival coming up on the 10th of August. Information on our website at WNPR.org. Mario Pavone bringing his street songs and accordion project at 1:45 in the afternoon. Jimmy Green with his quartet at 3:45 in the afternoon. But a lot of other great music happening throughout the course of the entire weekend at the Litchfield Jazz Festival. I want to thank Mario Pavone and Jimmy Green for joining us here and for playing some music in studio. Great to see you both. Thank you for joining us on Where We Live.
Thanks, John.
Pleasure, John. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll listen to a mother talk about her experience in coming to terms with life as the parent of a young transgender child. It's a follow-up on a recent show of ours. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, new changes to Connecticut's electricity laws have sought to create transparency in the marketing practices of third-party electric suppliers. We'll take a look at some of those changes and see how they're impacting the state's residential consumers. Some consumer talk coming up on the next Where We Live. Next, we're going to revisit a conversation we had a few weeks back, which focused on the rights and identity of transgender Americans.
I think the big thing, the real reason why we've seen a lot of movement on LGB issues,
yes,
is that a lot of people know somebody. There's somebody in your family. There's a friend that you have who is lesbian, gay, or bisexual. And as more people come out, they become more visible and it becomes more acceptable. So now suddenly you're not dealing with this abstract. You're dealing with, oh, well, this is my friend whose rights I'm trying to protect. But because the transgender community is so small, there's still a lot of people who assume that they've never met a transgender person in their life, even though they probably have.
That's Susan Bigelow, an openly transgender political columnist for CT News Junkie, speaking with us on Where We Live. Today, transgender Americans continue to face a number of social and legal issues, and despite recent political efforts to beef up the nation's transgender rights laws, these issues still haven't gotten as much attention as many would like to see. That's why today we'd like to bring you an episode from Marlo Mack's podcast, How to Be a Girl, which sheds light on transgender identity, documenting daily life with Marlo's young transgender daughter and sharing her experiences in learning to accept her child for who she really is. Here's Mama, I'm a Girl from How to Be a Girl on Where We Live.
Six years ago, I gave birth to my first and only child, a boy.
Hello. I am 38. I'm 29, and I really love you.
When he was 2 years old, my son began insisting on wearing only pink clothes, preferably ones with lots of sparkles and ruffles on them.
She just is so pretty. She really loves me.
When he turned 3, he begged me to buy him some dresses and let him grow his hair long. That made the grandparents a little nervous, but we went with it.
So her dress comes off?
It's kind of hard. It would hurt. That one's a fairy and that one's a princess.
Why is she a fairy and she's a princess?
Because fairies are magic and princesses don't. That's the difference. And also, they can't fly and they can't. Fairy fly and princesses walk.
And then one day, in a conversation that I kind of knew was coming, but it still knocked the wind out of me, my child told me that he was actually a girl, not a boy. He looked me in the eyes and told me something had gone wrong in my tummy that made him come out as a boy instead of a girl. He wanted me to put him back. He begged me to put him back, to fix this mistake. He was 3 years old. I spent the following year resisting, trying to present alternatives. I told my child over and over again that he could continue to be a boy and play with all the Barbies he wanted, and wear whatever he liked, dresses, skirts, all the sparkles money could buy. But my child said no, absolutely not. She was a girl.
What are your favorite things to play with?
My princess things.
Your princess things? Why do you like princesses so much?
I just kind of do.
Do you think it's okay for boys to like princesses?
But I'm a girl.
After 12 long months of making both myself and my child miserable, I finally let my little boy go.
Goodbye. Hello! Now let's do it. Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
We switched to female pronouns and told our family and friends that she was a girl now. She wanted a new name, a girl name.
How did it go?
At first, she picked Rainbow. I was relieved when she changed her mind and named herself after her aunt. So now I have a girl.
Talk about princesses.
A daughter.
Actually, I need to hear about how spaceships fly.
A really happy daughter. I adore my daughter. But sometimes, I look at photos of my baby boy, and I miss him so much. This probably sounds crazy, but sometimes I wonder where he is. It's like he was a dream I had one night, and then morning came, and I woke up, and he was gone. And now there's this little girl in his place, telling me that the boy was just a dream, just someone I imagined. As far as she is concerned, there never was a boy.
Could you explain that to me one more time? What's the difference between you and Holly?
She has a vagina and I have a penis. I'm a girl with a penis and she's a girl with a vagina.
You're a girl with a penis and she's a girl with a vagina?
Yes.
So now that I have a daughter instead of a son, what does this actually mean for her? And for me as her mother?
Pink is a mama. Pink is a mama.
Other than letting her wear pretty dresses and using different pronouns, what has actually changed? What does this newly minted girl need to know? What do I need to teach her about how to be a girl?
A girl alien does all the work while the boy alien sleeps and eats.
Do I even know how to be a girl?
The girls also have blue and purple spots.
And if a girl can be a senator or an astronaut or a plumber, if a girl can wear pants and have short hair, if a girl can even have a penis, what is a girl anyway?
Who gets to decide if you're a boy or girl?
Me!
That was Marlo Mack, who produces How to Be a Girl, a podcast about daily life with her transgender daughter. You can check out more of Marlo's work on PRX, that's the Public Radio Exchange, where we found the story, or by visiting marlomack.com. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Have a great weekend.